From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back.
Don, my pleasure, as always.
Yeah, so, okay, we've done so far in your review of the imperialist attacks on the rising BRICS construct. We've done B for Brazil, S for South Africa, and I for India. We have not yet touched on R for Russia or C for China. Interesting little powwow in Washington, D.C. Thursday and Friday this past week. The so-called nuclear summit hosted by the United States, the child of Barack Obama's April 2009 speech in Prague, where he promised to work to eliminate nuclear weapons. That was a few years before he ended up promising to spend $1.1 trillion modernizing and adapting the United States nuclear force, the largest single expenditure on weapons in human history.
Yeah, isn't that cute the way that he did that?
Yeah. So Russia said we're not going. They said that this framework is bogus. The framework for really dealing with these issues already exists, and that framework is the IAEA and also the protocols under the various arms control treaties that we have all signed. So they weren't there, even though Washington says Russia is the largest single holder of nuclear warheads, with some 8,000 warheads. China was there, and President Xi made a very strong statement on two points about the United States. One, to stop messing with their sovereignty, and two, stop messing with their national interests. So let's talk about China.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about this too, and I mean, as you're speaking about it, I was just trying to pick up what I could from the New York Times, 2 days ago. And it's interesting because in the midst of this nuclear security summit, you have a headline, New York Times, that's our, you know, our glorious paper of record here in the United States. As Obama hosts nuclear security summit, the focus is on China. Wait, what? How did that happen? Because I thought this was a nuclear summit, and China is nowhere close to the nuclear power that either Russia or the United States is. So I think we can already see what this is actually about. That on the one hand, as you, I think you were alluding to there, Don, this is a public relations move. Obama trying to, you know, Obama in legacy mode, trying to kind of, you know, pad up his reputation as this, you know, nuclear non-proliferation president and so forth, despite the fact that he is probably the biggest proliferator that we've had. And the fact of the matter is that this is really about geopolitics. And of course, we know the burning issues as far as geopolitics and strategy go vis-a-vis China, the South China Sea, what's happening there, the northern islands disputes between China and Japan over the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands. Of course, everything that's still going on around North Korea, including the nuclear missile testing and all of the, you know, the bluff and the bluster from Pyongyang. And then, of course, at the broader level, Chinese economic development as it set against or juxtaposed against U.S. attempts to stifle Chinese economic development as much as that is possible. And so with all of these things swirling in the background, we have this article from the New York Times, and I just find it really interesting where the second sentence of the article says, quote, "But it was Mr. Obama's meeting with one of the less friendly of those leaders, President Xi Jinping of China, that captured most of the attention," right? And this talks about, you know, some of these agreements that they have made and so forth. But really, I think the issue comes down to, is China being treated as, you know, an equal partner here, or is China being dictated to? And I would, of course, argue the latter. And I think that what we've seen from the United States, in particular, some of the military moves, things like, you know, Ashton Carter on a U.S. naval vessel going right through Chinese territorial waters or right up against territorial waters, as we've seen with the attempts to institute the so-called China's desire to institute an ADIZ, the Air Defense Identification Zone, and the United States saying that they're basically violating various treaties, that they're violating freedom of navigation, all of these things. I think all of these really point to something that I think is probably the most important here, and that is that China is now seen, along with Russia, as enemy number one here. It's not simply an economic partner or an economic driver. The blast furnace of global capitalism. It is now an adversary, clearly and unmistakably. And I think that that's what they're talking about when Obama says that China needs not pursue militarization. What is he really saying? He's saying that China should not assert its sovereignty, its territorial integrity against the United States and its proxies in the region. And I think that that's probably the main reason why Xi Jinping came to this summit in the first place, because I think, like Putin, he knows that this is kind of a sham, that this is really a charade, that this was an attempt by President Xi to stand before leaders and say, we will not be dictated to.
You know, it's interesting as hell that they frame, at New York Times frames Xi Jinping in this way. When you're talking about the president of the country's largest trading partner by, you know, maybe in order of magnitude. The U.S. government itself, you know, finances its daily operations selling paper, much of which is sold to China. I mean, if China didn't buy that paper, just stopped buying it, there would be a serious financial crisis facing the U.S. government. So looking at them as one of the less friendly players on the planet is an odd, you know, odd framing of it in terms of the material reality. But you also have this move by, looks like one of the regime change moves they're stirring up, this so-called mysterious letter. I'm looking at Caleb Maupin's article at New Eastern Outlook the other day. The mysterious letter is Washington plotting against Xi Jinping. And he refers to the letter this way. It says, it raised the same criticism of Xi that is constantly raised in the Western press, accusing him of centralizing power and breaking from the collective leadership. Then it accuses him of antagonizing the U.S., and it condemns his anti-corruption campaign, saying that it's paralyzing government bureaucrats, making them afraid, and demanded that he step down. It's supposedly a group of loyal Communist Party members. That's how it's been signed, but they're anonymous so far.
Yeah, there's a couple of things happening there. We had this resignation letter, and this was obviously picked up by all the Western media, played up endlessly. I don't think anybody really took it seriously. I think the larger question is, how exactly did that letter get up there? You know, how did it get published, especially since this was published in, you know, very mainstream Communist Party channels? Now, the question that I would have, I mean, my immediate question is this real? In other words, who made this? Where did this come from? From my perspective, I think the most obvious question is, did the United States do this? Is this an example of a cyber psychological warfare? I think that there is definitely certain indications that that might be the case. You know, Peter Lee at his blog and published on Asia Times has written about this. And I think that he, you know, has a very good point here, that we do have circumstantial evidence that possibly the United States was behind this, including the fact that the United States has been recruiting hackers who they have basically made deals with after they've been implicated by the FBI in various criminal actions to possibly carry out exactly this sort of psyop, particularly against China. So that question, I think, is obviously out there. there, and I think that it needs to be thought of quite seriously. Also, of course, the potential that there is, you know, an insider or a mole or an agent working on behalf of the United States and of the enemies of China within the bureaucracy, who is putting this out there for, again, for disinformation, psychological warfare. But there are a couple of other, I think, major issues that need to be addressed. Also, we had this this commentary, this so-called yes man commentary, right? That was posted on the website. It's interesting because it was actually posted on the anti-corruption website, the anti-corruption, what is it called? The Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, which Xi Jinping established when he came to power, and he's led this anti-corruption crusade. And so this letter is posted there, and it basically says, you know, obviously, very brief summary. Basically, the letter says Xi Jinping is censoring media. He is centralizing power. He is creating a personality cult of yes men. And obviously, the reference here, and this is not lost on people in China, the reference here is a callback to Mao and the Cultural Revolution and the excesses of that period. So basically, it's saying that Xi Jinping is a new Mao and that he is trying to undo the decades of, I guess you could say, well, depending on perspective, the repair from that period. Now, there's another question that comes to my mind as I read this, and I don't want to take total credit for it. Peter Lee wrote about this. I'm basically just pulling it from him, but it's, I think, a very good point, and that is, why is this letter, after multiple weeks, I think it's been 3.5 weeks, why is this letter still published? Why is it still up there? If the censorship and the media campaign, centralization and all of these things around a cult of personality, if that's all really embedded in China the way that they claim that it is, why is this piece still posted after weeks?
You know, now, what it reminds me of in Venezuela with the right-wing National Assembly still continuing. They got elected, voting out the party that was in power before, referring to President Maduro as a dictator, and saying, let's vote him out.
yeah, exactly. He's a dictator, let's vote him out. Right. And so the question is, and I mean, you know, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but it really strikes me as very odd here. Why would a letter so deeply critical of Xi Jinping, who is allegedly centralizing all of this power and going forward with all this censorship, why is that still up there? Now, I don't know. I mean, I'm very interested to hear your take on it, Don. The way that I read it, there's two possibilities here. Number one is that the letter remains published and is up there because Xi Jinping is allowing it to be, because he wants to make sure that he is not further accused of censorship. He wants to make sure that people both in China and around the world see that dissenting opinions, even when they break the party line, the mass line that he's trying to rebuild, as Caleb wrote in that article that you mentioned earlier, that even those who break from the line, that they're not going to be persecuted, that alternative views, alternative opinions are allowed. Now, the second possibility here, and I think that they are not necessarily mutually exclusive, is the fact that this letter actually further serves Xi Jinping's purposes, because it, in effect, it serves as a warning to anybody who might want to be challenging Xi Jinping publicly. And that's really, I think, the key question here, because we have had these struggles, and then there are various members inside of the ruling establishment who have in various ways worked with Xi Jinping up to now, including a guy named Liu Yunshan, who is one of the main, I guess you could say, propagandists, or one of the main controllers of the propaganda arm for the Chinese Communist Party. Now, is Mr. Liu involved in putting this up there because he has a problem with Xi Jinping, because he thinks that Xi Jinping has gone too far, Or is he allowing this to stay up there because he thinks that it serves Xi Jinping's interests by portraying him as a much more lenient, much more tolerant, much more open leader than the Western media would portray? I think both of those are very real possibilities.
Okay, so we have the possibility, and they actually, you know, can meld as well, that the origin of this is either, you know, U.S. intelligence, ultimately, whatever, for lack of a better term, and or something indigenous, some faction or factions inside, or, of course, those two working together. And so, you know, we've been looking at the response by the U.S. and EU and Japan and Korea, South Korea, you know, whatever you want to call the Western imperial construct, to the rise of the BRICS and multipolarity generally, like in Latin America and even in Africa somewhat. And we've been particularly focusing that on the BRICS, which is, the subject matter of your series. And so let's look at this in that vein. Let's say it's the U.S. and or some indigenous dissent that's being expressed here. What's the whole contextual, what's the whole of the attack that's being leveled against China right now?
Well, I think that there's a couple. I guess I led off a little bit with that, but maybe we should go more in depth. I guess it was about 2 weeks ago now, there was a very important summit. I believe it was held in India. I can't remember offhand, but basically the summit was a confab of the leading nations of South Asia. India was there, Sri Lanka was there, some of the Southeast Asian countries, I believe, were there, Pakistan and a few others, I think Nepal and Bhutan perhaps. Anyway, the point is, this summit was specifically designed around the question of the OBOR, right? That's the OBOR, the One Belt, One Road Initiative of China. Now, this is what could be described as a comprehensive, not just regional, but in fact, global, or at least Eurasian, if not entirely global, economic development initiative led by China to essentially create infrastructure and trade cooperation throughout the Eurasian space, and also including the maritime Silk Road that China has been pursuing, which of course connects China commercially through some of its interests stretching all the way from Asia to Africa. And now all of these initiatives, whether it's the development of highways and roads, such as in Pakistan, whether it's the development of railways connecting China to Iran, whether it's the development of airports and, you know, connecting the west of China to Russia and to other countries, all of these things are really part of this larger framework, the One Belt, One Road Initiative. And so this meeting was basically a question of how to incorporate China's One Belt, One Road into a South Asian development strategy. And the main thing, there's a lot of things that are mentioned there, but the main takeaway that I got from reading about this and reading firsthand sources, people who were there, who were writing about it, was that there was almost a consensus among all but one of the countries, basically, that they need to increase their cooperation with China, that they need to make sure that they develop their partnerships, they allow Chinese FDI, foreign direct investment, they move forward with this form of cooperation with China. In other words, going against this stereotype of China as the big bad bully on the block, right? That China's bullying all of these nations in Southeast Asia and South Asia, that China is somehow to be feared rather than to be seen as a partner in all of this. So Sri Lanka and all of these other countries were saying precisely that. And we've seen over the course of the last few years, countries just like Sri Lanka who have increased their cooperation with China for ports and roads and all of the rest of that. The dissenting voice, for better or worse, is India. Now, this is, I think, the major focal point of U.S. policy and of the assault on the BRICS.
And that takes place in the just to remind our listeners from our discussion last week, this takes place in the context of the U.S. Making these military agreements with India.
Yeah, exactly. So three major military agreements being signed between the U.S. and India, which basically makes India a de facto military ally of the United States. Now, they won't say that formally, but I think informally that is pretty much what we're seeing now. So India comes out and basically says, not that they don't want to, cooperate with China. They don't want to have that. They're not going to put it so plainly, but in the subtext of what was said, it was basically that India, although they have this quote-unquote look east policy, which we've seen over the course of the last few years, that India seems to be making moves towards the West, increasingly so. And this makes sense. I think if you look at it broadly, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, his politics and his economic outlook is neoliberal. His economic outlook is neoliberal. His politics is right-wing reactionary, nationalist, perhaps ultra-nationalist. If you talk to some friends in India, that's what they would say. So this is really, I think, the strategic tension here. India sees in China a rival. It sees a power that it cannot really compete with economically. And so instead, it seems to be repositioning itself to look westward. Now, if that's the case, and I think it is to a large extent, then what you have is a wedge being driven directly into the heart of the BRICS. Because, of course, the division between China and India increases the problems for cooperation between China and Russia. India and Russia have historic relations going back decades. They continue to maintain relatively, not just warm relations, but pretty close relations. Now, if India is getting pried out of the BRICS orbit and into the U.S. orbit, what does that do for BRICS as a whole? What does that do for India-Russia relations? And what does that do for India-China relations, which are historically very, very tense? Don't forget, India and China continue to have a border dispute that remains unresolved, India being the seat of the Dalai Lama and of anti-China propaganda, India being in many ways the home, or rather maybe we should say the launch point for a lot of the destabilization actions against China. And so the heart of BRICS and the heart of the future of BRICS always was dependent upon the continued mending offenses between India and China. So what I see from my perspective is the United States desperately looking, on the one hand, to destabilize China internally through all of these domestic squabbles, the propaganda stuff, all of the rest of that, but at the larger level, trying to drive this wedge into BRICS via India.
And it's interesting, the acronym itself more or less betrays the geographic nature and the historical nature of the relationship, because you have the RIC inside the BRICS. You have Russia, India, and China, which are contiguous to one another.
Yep.
You have this sort of trilateral relationship that has evolved historically among the three. And then you have, the largest economy or one of the largest economies in the Western Hemisphere, in Latin America, at one end, B for Brazil, and one of the two largest economies in Africa, South Africa, on the other. Sort of just added in, like, here's the core group, RIC, now we're going to go global, we'll grab somebody in South America and somebody in Africa to start, and here's our BRICS. India is at the center of that. The I is the third or the fifth letter, coincidentally, and it seems to be at the center of this. Looking at what you described, the construction of this one belt, one road, basically the new Silk Road, also the part of it that would go through Russia with the rail link and all that is being developed. If India were to turn westward and look westward, that whole thing gets built except for the China leg. And so, India needs to have construction of that road as badly as China, perhaps more so, because it needs the increase in its economy more than China does. And so how does India accomplish the construction of this In other words, increasing its access to Europe over this, you know, pathway without China financing it and or building it.
Well, that's part of the issue here, and I think that there's quite likely to be internal conflicts even within India's establishment over that question. But I don't know. I mean, does India really see itself as a major supplier of Western consumer goods in the way that China is? Does it really see it as a competitor? I'm not sure, because I think that there are philosophical differences even within India, because there's a lot of talk in Indian circles that what they would like is regional hegemon status, in particular that India is trying to build out this infrastructure that allows it to exert influence throughout the South Asian and potentially now Central Asian region as well. Now, I give a couple of examples of that. India is financing the major port at Chabahar in Iran. Chabahar port is seen by many as India's answer to China's Gwadar port in Pakistan. So if you have this sort of developing competition between these two countries over what amounts to access to the Indian Ocean via ports, rather I should say access for raw materials to the Indian Ocean via these ports, you begin to see some of the ways in which India sees China not as a partner but as a competitor. One example of that, I think, is Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, as this war in Afghanistan, which seemingly never ends, which seemingly is getting worse, but theoretically, at least, it is at some point going to end. And China has positioned itself as a central mediator in this potential end for the war in Afghanistan. If you recall, I believe it was the end of 2014, in the beginning of 2015, China was the initiator of a meeting with the Taliban, not Taliban representatives, but not Taliban representatives in Qatar, the traditional, Taliban representatives to the West, but the actual Taliban leaders, right? They had actual Taliban leaders meeting with representatives of the Afghan government under the auspices of China. Now, to me, that's a clear indication that China is trying to make itself into a central player in the political future of Afghanistan in a post-war landscape. At the same time, you have India vying for some of the most lucrative mining concessions in Afghanistan for like iron ore, and I think some rare earth minerals and some other things as well, coming out of Afghanistan, needing to travel down to the port at Chabahar in order to then come to India, because of course Pakistan makes any transit over land impossible and various other logistical concerns. So you see a regional geopolitical and strategic dynamic emerging here in which India sees itself, yes, on the one hand, benefiting from cooperation with China, but also simultaneously in competition with China. And I think that tension, the benefit versus competition, or rather cooperation versus competition, I think that's what the United States is really trying to exploit here. And that's why the U.S. is moving in militarily to try to bring India into the fold in order to drive these potential partners further apart.
You know, one of the ways that the primary way, I think, that the U.S. in the post-World War II period was able to secure its position in Western Europe was by integrating the European elites into the structure that came into existence afterward, the relationship between the United States and Western Europe. It seems pretty clear, listening to what you described, that perhaps that integration has not taken place among the members of the BRICS, that the elites there see themselves as competitors, and that this would explain, of course, exactly this kind of divergent approach to even security.
Well, and it's not something that really should come as a surprise. This is something that we've known for a long time that probably was one of the main, if not the main hurdle for BRICS and the other multilateral institutions, of course, Shanghai Cooperation Organization and Eurasian Economic Union, all the rest of them, but really BRICS at the largest level. The major problem here is that BRICS is not a real thing. BRICS is a construct. Goldman Sachs coined the term. You know, it is almost like a public relations construct that kind of took material form, if you will, after, you know, almost like the acronym came first and then the, you know, I guess organization emerges after that, if we can call it an organization. And the problem is, as you're alluding to, Don, and you're absolutely right, the problem is that actual integration and cooperation has to overcome a lot of these problems. For one thing, Indian elites, business elites, and political elites, where are they educated? They're educated in the West.
That's true.
They're educated in London, primarily, in the United States.
There's a whole imperial legacy, too. I mean, the Indian government structures were integrated into the British Empire.
Yeah, exactly right. So, a lot of the heads of the judiciary, a lot of the political leadership, a lot of them really look west, not only in terms of their, you know, business relations, but they look west in terms of their own sort of psyche, right? That it's ingrained in them in a lot of ways. Yeah. At the same time, we also have embedded here this lingering problem of the Sino-Soviet split. Right, you had this Russia-China competition that lasted for decades, and in many ways, that the legacy of that is still with us today. Now, sure, we've seen Russia and China move closer together. I've written about that. You've talked about that endlessly, as have many, many other pundits and analysts. The major cooperation for the next 30 years in terms of energy, energy trade, in terms of the development of increased infrastructure, all of these things, all of that is true. But there is also still a fundamental distrust. There is still this question of China's elites and Russia's elites, independent of each other, are both clearly and unmistakably also westernized. Right? That's one of the problems in Russia. One of the problems in China is that even many of their elites, even those who are now looking away from the West, still have in their minds a westernized outlook. That is part of the legacy of imperialism, of the British Empire, of U.S. Imperial dominance since World War II. You see this in terms of cultural indicators in China. You see this in terms of what Xi Jinping has been pushing back against is this decades of westernization of Chinese culture. The same is true in Russia. So this, and that's kind of why it's so funny that, the United States and Europe imposed these sanctions on Russia, almost, daring them to accelerate their de-westernization. You know what I mean? So in many ways, I think that is, on the one hand, been a very potent weapon against Russia's economy, which we should probably talk about. But secondarily, it is also kind of backfiring on them by driving Russia further eastward. So a lot of these internal philosophical conflicts, I think, have their sort of translation in the politics.
I think we'll get into Russia next week, but the one of the things that catches my eye when you mention the political landscape and the lack of a structure there, or in any event, the low level of development of integration among them is, they're following what I call the Chavez model, basically, where we seek common interests with you regardless of the nature of your political system and the nature of your economy. We are a socialist country and we have our constitution. We don't care what your constitution is, and we don't care how you organize production in your country. If we got some business to do together, let's do it. And we both face the same threat in terms of our security and our sovereignty from the United States. Let's band against that. Now, you saw that develop first among the ALBA countries, which are fairly similar systems of politics and economy. and then grew through various other structures up to and including Salak and Unasur, which has almost every country south of the Rio Grande. There are contradictions that have been farmed inside of that system, of course, but it is a much further level of development in terms of structures than the BRICS thus far. And with the contradictions that face those countries in the Southern Hemisphere here are not quite as intensive as, say, the contradictions between China and India. How, looking at that as a model, what can at least the core of this group do, which is really where the issue stands at the moment, what can they do to work through it, to try to integrate the, you know, find the most common denominators of interest among them and pursue those as a primary goal?
Well, I mean, I think to some degree that is what they're doing. You know, they're trying to, how should we put it, trying to sort of play to each other's strengths, right? Russia's strengths economically and politically, for that matter, is energy exports and high technology in terms of military capabilities, right? That is precisely what they have been offering to China and what China has been very happy to accept. And I think we see that in the example of the 30-year, $500 billion contract between China and Russia for gas deliveries.
Right after the sanctions, by the way, which also had displayed another dynamic, which is that they recognized that in the face of U.S. power being exerted against one of them, that they can play to their strengths and stand against it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And of course, the other one that needs to be remembered is the S-400 missile system, right? Which is Russia's great breakthrough, at least in the area of military defense capabilities. And that's, of course, very significant for China as we alluded to earlier, look at the South China Sea, look at the squabbling with Japan, look at some of these other conflicts, including the Korean Peninsula, including Taiwan, including all of these other issues where the United States has been really pushing hard against China militarily. So China has this insurance policy to some degree, at least it's an insurance policy. And that's thanks to Moscow. So this is the kind of partnership I think that is in many ways pretty significant here. But you're absolutely right. The contradictions between the BRICS countries and the historical tensions between them are much more significant and much more difficult to overcome than, say, among the ALBA countries or even among Latin American countries generally, because even the countries in Latin America, maybe with the exception of Colombia, but all of the rest of them are to varying degrees have a very negative outlook towards the United States. They had this common bond that really brought them all together, and that was the historical legacy of U.S. imperialism, the Monroe Doctrine, all of these things where all of these countries had a vested interest in getting together. And of course, also Venezuela was able to foster a lot of these relations with things like Petrocaribe and, right, you know, the supplying of energy at below market costs to a lot of the countries in the Caribbean, in Latin America. So there were, I think, material factors driving these countries closer together at a time when, you know, oil prices were high, when, you know, Latin America had moved significantly to the left. Much of that, of course, being due, you know, in credit to Chavez himself and, you know, some of the other leaders that have emerged or that had emerged at the time. In the East, in the China-Russia dynamic, we see something very different. Those countries in Latin America were not targeted and isolated and attacked in the same way that the Russia and China are. Remember, when those countries in Latin America were developing their closer cooperation, this was in the wake of 9/11. This is the war on terror. This is when the Bush administration is fighting a war in Iraq, when much of U.S. foreign policy is focused on the Middle East, is focused on a lot of those issues. The Latin American countries were able to, as to whatever degree this is possible, fly under the radar of U.S. foreign policy, and they were able to move closer together, and Chavez was this larger-than-life figure. today's landscape is vastly different. It's incredible how much it's changed in the last decade, but it has. And in China and Russia, you see the number one and number two, depending on, you know, which you want to put at the top spot, enemies and targets of U.S. destabilization and U.S. foreign policy. So on the one hand, I do think that Latin America is a model. On the other hand, I think the set of circumstances and the difficulties are vastly different.
I agree with that. And you do have, again, that legacy of colonialism that lingers in those three as well. You know, you have also another dichotomy, which occurs in, say, picking India, within India, the divergence of interest, essentially, of the people of India and the elites, particularly the economic elites. China, for example, India has, the Indian population has great needs that are still unmet. And China could very easily just ship TVs, food, whatever it is that's needed among the population, you know, and charge it somewhere, maybe using some U.S. paper. Of course, that doesn't promote the development of indigenous industry in India, which is in the interest of the class that would own that and profit from it. So there's the potential for there's a divergence of interest, you know, from between the population and the native elite, and the native elite seems to be throwing in with the West, hoping to be able to compete better with China. How, you know, how does that play out?
Well, look, there's two distinctly different, I think, things that need to be discussed here. China and India are, I mean, diametrically opposed systems, right? In China, the ruling elite, meaning the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party, you know, whatever you want to say about them, and I could list to probably a number of things that we could say that are quite critical of them. But no matter what you want to say, whether you're a Sinophile, whether you're anti-China, whatever, I don't think anybody would dispute that the Chinese Communist Party works in obviously in its own interests, but its own interests are to lift up the general population in China, to raise standards of living, to increase access to healthcare and to, you know, education and all these other things, because that's what its survival depends on.
And that's what it's been doing.
Of course. I mean, you're right. It goes without saying in my mind, but you're right. We should reiterate, hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty in China over the last, six decades? Actually, it could even be shorter than that, four decades.
Yeah. Obama was required to say that. He said that last time Xi Jinping was in Washington.
Exactly right. So China has done that. Now, you know, its rapid industrialization and economic development have had negative repercussions as well. But, you know, on the grand scheme of things, it's been incredibly successful. India, I think, is vastly different. In China, they, for the most part, destroyed the legacy of feudalism. That was one of the major developments in China after 1949, was the destruction of the Chinese feudal society. And that was forcibly destroyed by the Communist Party. India is in many ways a neo-feudal society. The caste system is very strong in India. The divisions between the elites and, you know, the lower castes, the untouchables, the, you know, the Dalits and all the rest of that, that is so deeply ingrained in Indian society that in many ways it's difficult for the economic elites and the economic interests in India to even consider hundreds of millions of people in India human beings at all. They don't see them. They don't see themselves as having any responsibility to lift them out of poverty. They don't see their role as, you know, developing India as a, you know, unified society that are, you know, bringing these groups of people together. They don't see it that way.
Is this like a feudal ideology in Europe, say in the 16th or 17th century? You know, that's an impediment to the development of capitalism.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. But the kind of capitalism that is being practiced in India is, I think, it's different because, you know, whereas capitalist development in Europe happens how should we say, organically, or, you know, it develops in the way that it, you know, well, it developed in the way that it developed. In India, capitalism and the development of capitalism has been within a colonial context. It has been the colonial cash cow, the crown in the, or the crown jewel of the British Empire, as it were, you know, a source of raw materials, a captive market, all of the rest of that. So India's development as a capitalist power has been in context of, or as an adjunct of, Western capitalism. Right. In China, China's development, I think, has been very different. You know, when it was a, you know, subjugated colony or quasi-colony of the British, that was one thing, but that's long in the past now. China is something very, very different today. And I think that this very difference in the models of these two countries, to a large extent, both politically and economically, I think that to a large extent accounts for the continued tensions. If you had in India a ruling elite that saw its role the same way that those elites in China see their role, as lifting people out of poverty, as breaking down these class distinctions, these caste definitions, as raising standards of living across the board, poverty reduction, all of that, if they saw it in that way, I think you would see much quicker cooperation and development between India and China, which would, of course, mean quicker integration of the BRICS countries.
So whatever your critiques of it, and I'm sure you have a list, as do I, maybe mine's short, I don't know. The Cultural Revolution in China set the stage for that kind of cultural, you know, basically the throwing off of a colonial mindset and of colonial structures. The capitalist class in India was created under the colonial system, and for up until very recently was still operating in terms of economics in the same way that it did when it was part of the British Empire. The mindset of those elites, the business connections of those elites, basically the fundamental power even of those elites rests on those colonial relationships. If they were to start, or some ascendant elite were to start looking at the untapped potential of those hundreds of millions of people in India who, you know, they should, if they could have a TV set, I would sell it to them. If they could have, you know, more food, I would sell it to them. In other words, that their interests lie in developing their own country. How do they get there?
Well, geez, that's a big question. I think there's a number of things that have to happen. I think number one is that India itself, and both at the grassroots level and at the larger political level, it has to break away from its captive role as far as Western capital goes. Look at the agriculture industry, right? I mean, some of the most egregious and heinous environmental crimes in modern history have been committed by Western corporations in India. Of course, the Bhopal incident, you know, comes to mind. A number of others we've seen. I mean, mass suicides among small Indian farmers, subsistence farmers, who get indebted because of this collaboration or integration of Indian agriculture into the global capitalist system. You've seen, the move away from indigenous development to integration into the larger big agra system globally. So I personally think that in order for India to really modernize in the way that I think it needs to, and in it's sort of part and parcel of breaking free from the Western system. In other words, Indian agriculture should be based on Indian development, Indian labor, Indian investment, all of those things. It should not be based dependent upon Monsanto and ConAgra and Cargill and all of the rest of these corporations, as to a large extent it is. We've seen the GMO question come up repeatedly in India. How much is India's vast agricultural sector, how much of that is going to be captive to Western corporations? If a significant amount, as it has been historically in the last couple of decades. If that continues, it's very difficult to envision India really developing in an independent fashion. If you look at some of these other countries, particularly Russia and China, you see, I think, to a large extent, the benefits of moving away from that Western dependence. I know that, you know, for instance, GMOs were recently banned in Russia. China has very strict regulations about Western agriculture. You know, that is historically embedded in China's agricultural policies. So
India has actually been making some moves in that direction as well with cotton.
Well, yes, that's what I'm. That's exactly what I'm pointing to, is that there are moves being made in that direction, but simultaneously, you see the orientation towards the West happening at the same time. So this is precisely the kind of contradiction that makes it problematic, just like we saw, for instance, when Indian businessmen, pharmaceutical, companies were selling pharmaceutical, pharmaceutical supplies and medical supplies to Iran when the United States had sanctions against Iran. India was given a voucher. They were able to continue doing that because they basically said to the United States, we're going to do this whether you put sanctions or not. And so that is an example of when the interests of Indian capitalists dovetailed with the interest in the development of a multipolar world. And if we can see more examples where Indian capitalist interests work hand in hand with the development of BRICS, that is where you're going to see this happening. Now, I'm not suggesting that, the interests of Indian billionaires really are, central to the development of the regular people of India. But I'm suggesting that if you want to see India breaking away from the West, given the current landscape, that is what it's going to look like. Obviously, in a utopian situation, in a real anti-capitalist direction, India would be, there would be a revolution. India would be remade just as China was remade in 1949 and Russia in 1917, of course. But that is obviously a long way off.
And to close back in China, with China looking at the U.S. machinations in India that threaten both its pathway to Europe and also the heart of the BRICS, and the installation of the U.S. military on China's western border, what the counter moves along the lines you were just describing, and also for Russia in terms of trying to harmonize the interests of the Indian elite into their actual policy, joint venture development of India and Indian industry. Is that being worked on, and is that a priority, you think, for China?
Well, in a sense, I think it is. Unfortunately, I think the elephant in the room when it comes to that issue is really India-Pakistan. I mean, the India-Pakistan question continues to plague the region. It continues to plague further multilateral integration in South Asia and in Asia generally. Remember that both India and Pakistan acceded to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, I think officially this year. Now, at the same time, we see continued conflict in Kashmir. We see continued saber rattling on both sides over a number of issues. We've seen, terrorism being fostered. We've seen all kinds of incidents. And I think that China's longstanding relationship with Pakistan and Russia's longstanding relationship with India might really hold the key to all of this, because if those two countries, meaning Russia and China, could somehow serve as brokers of even a tentative and lukewarm peace between India and Pakistan, that could really unlock the tremendous potential of South Asia and the tremendous potential of Asia, broadly speaking. I think that if you saw a resolution, even a first step towards a resolution of that conflict, it could really, I think, resolve a lot of the contradictions all throughout the region.
And on that note, we'll end here. Eric, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.